People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. A particularly interesting book has just been published called To the Fairest Cape, European Encounters in the Cape of Good Hope. And on the flyleaf it says that crossing the remote southern tip of Africa has fired the imagination of European travellers from the time of Bartholomew Dias, when he opened up the passage to the east by rounding the Cape of Good Hope in 1488. And then Dutch, British, French, Danes, and Swedes formed an endless stream of seafarers who made their long journeys southwards in pursuit of wealth, adventure, science, and missionary, as well as outright national interest. Now, this book has been written by Sir Malcolm Jack, an author, critic, and university lecturer, brought up in Hong Kong, and he had a career in the British Parliament, gaining prominence as an authority on constitutional matters. From his first visit to South Africa, he felt a strong affinity with the diversity of Cape society and an enthusiasm for its cosmopolitan traveller's history. He was appointed KCB in 2011. So it's my pleasure now to welcome Sir Malcolm Jack to Fine Music Radio and to People of Note.
Thank you very much, Rodney, for your welcome.
I'm most intrigued, having read, because that was a quote from you that I read about crossing the remote southern tip of Africa from your introduction. But I'm most intrigued. You've written a number of books, but what possessed you to settle down and write a book like this, which is a most unusual subject, I think?
Well, I think there are various things that led me to it. The first is that, as you probably know, I had some connection with Portugal and Portuguese background to my mother's family. And I guess I always knew about Bartholomew Dias rounding the Cape of Good Hope. Then when I came here to Cape Town for the first time, which was quite a long time ago, I was immediately taken by the diversity, really, of the society, as well, of course, as the beauty of the city, which everyone else enjoys as well. And that led me to think, who were the original inhabitants here and what was written about them? So that was really the origin of the book.
And how have you structured the book? Because it's actually, if you think about it, as you've just said, it's actually quite a vast subject. And I see from some dates at the beginning here, you go right back to many, many years BC, actually, to see who was roaming around here millions of years ago. It must have been, A, fascinating to research, and B, actually quite tricky.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, one always has to sort of decide what the scope of a book is anyway. But in this case, the reason I went so far back was that I thought that we really had to know who the Khoisan were in order to make sense of the encounter that they had with the Europeans, or the Europeans had with them. And so that's why the beginning of the book looks at the Khoi and the San and tries to put some context to them.
Yes, because you begin with an intriguing title, Ancient and Mythological Place, Mythical Place. And was it easy and interesting to discover all these things? Were people a great help to you locally?
Yes, very helpful indeed. In fact, in the acknowledgement to the book, I hope I have included everyone who was helpful. But archivists, both at the National Library and in your parliament, where there's a very good collection of visual, historical images, and the booksellers of Long Street, as well, of course, as scholars and so on. But Everyone has been extremely helpful.
I'm amazed. You're talking about 6 to 8 million years ago for the early hominids walking upright, populating eastern southern Africa. It's incredible to think it was that long ago, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, as you know, the origin of life has been traced to Africa, although now there seem to be, as usual, different theories about where men we now regard as Homo sapiens emerged from. Mm-hmm. But certainly the occupation in Africa is very, very ancient.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and this perhaps is a bit more detailed, is some of the intriguing titles of your chapters. For example, Paradise Lost and Paradise Gained. Just whet my appetite a little bit there for people who are going to buy this book. Whet our appetites, I should say.
Yes, I think perhaps there's a slightly rose-tinted spectacles in these titles. I think what I was coming to the conclusion of was that these Kosan, although without pretending that their life was easy, because of course it wasn't, you know, as we all know, life expectancy was probably very low indeed, nevertheless lived in a kind of paradise. The Cape, as everyone knows, is not only a beautiful place, a fertile place. It had plenty of game, so hunting was not difficult. And they roamed around. So that was a kind of paradise. And it's seen in that way later on by romantic writers.
Mm-hmm. So Paradise Lost is not necessarily a negative thing.
Not really, no. I think it's a change, if you mm-hmm. like. That nomadic existence came to an end when the Europeans arrived and started to settle, to use the term.
How far do you take the book? Started 6 million years ago. have you come right forward into the sort of 21st century?
No, it stops really in 1832-33 when the slavery was abolished in the British Empire. And the reason for that really is I thought that that was in a certain way the end of the colonial chapter of South African history. And so there had to be an end somewhere.
Right, okay. Malcolm, we take a little music break now, and I'm intrigued to hear your choice of music. And I see Delius is up first. Tell me why you've chosen Delius by the river from his Florida suite.
Oh, it's just his melodiousness and the peace of the piece, which I particularly like.
Let's enjoy some Delius, true English music.
Thank you.
The music of Frederick Delius, that's from his Florida Suites, the movement called By the River, a very typical sound of Delius, and the choice of my guest on People of Note this week, Sir Malcolm Jack, whose latest book, To the Fairest Cape, European Encounters in the Cape of Good Hope, has just been published. Malcolm, I mentioned two or three paragraphs, or chapters I should say, but another one that interests me is Adamastor's Reign. What is that? That's an intriguing title.
Adamastor was an invention of the Portuguese poet Luís Camões, who wrote the Lusíadas, which is the kind of epic piece for Portuguese literature, which describes Vasco da Gama's trip to the East. And in it, he invented this mythological character, Adamastor, who lurks in the sea underneath the Cape and threatens anyone who comes near. So it's a kind of rather frightening image, mm-hmm. very much in the kind of neoclassical European context.
A sort of typical myth, as we say, mythical figure in sense.
Absolutely, yes, typical myth. Yeah.
When you were talking just now about Cape Town and how beautiful it is, I am right in saying that since your first visit here to Cape Town, you've been sort of rather captivated by the place, and you now are a regular visitor from the UK.
Absolutely, yes. I feel I'm an honorary Capetonian, if there is such a thing.
Are you able to say, Malcolm, what it is you like about Cape Town?
Oh, I think it is very difficult, isn't it? One is just captured by a place. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the setting of Cape Town is spectacular, and you're very near nature, which is very nice. You mm-hmm. can get out of the city very easily. But I think the thing that really appeals to me is this mixture. It's jumble of different races, of different tribes, all the tribes, I would call, including the European ones. And its liveliness in that sense. So I think it's the combination of the mixture and the physical setting.
And then on the other side, say on a professional side, and we'll get to your career in the British Houses of Parliament in a moment, but you've certainly had a fair amount to do with the Parliament here, haven't you? In what respect? Tell us how you became involved with Parliament here.
That was some time ago when I was still working in the House of Commons. And I thought that, I suppose because of my own direct connection with South Africa, that relations between the two parliaments, between the UK Parliament and the South African Parliament, should be improved. So I managed to make contact with people here, and we had a few regular visits to and fro. And in 2012, the Speaker of the House of Commons came down here on invitation. And that sort of sealed this relationship.
Okay, so it was a success. You achieved something there by the sounds of things.
Yes, I think I did, yes.
And I'd like to talk also about what you did in the House of Commons, because your title, Clerk of the House, can be misleading. So perhaps just explain to me what Clerk of the House actually is.
Yes, it is. It's a medieval term, of course, clerk, and therefore, as you say, it is misleading. The clerk of the House is the principal advisor to the Speaker and to the House as a whole, and that's very important, that qualification, about the procedures and practices of the House, which can be quite arcane, as I'm sure some of your listeners, having tried to follow recent events in the Commons, will realize.
Yes, gosh. I bet you're glad you're not there just at the moment.
I think it's better to be an observer at the moment.
So the clerk of the House, obviously he cannot belong to any party. He's got to be completely autonomous in many ways. But it's a fairly senior role in that it deals mostly with constitutional issues. You're advising ministers, are you, on constitutional matters?
Yes, it is pretty senior. Ministers, as members of the House, of course, but really principally the Speaker and members of the House rather than the government. So you're a Parliament man rather than a government man.
Then a government man. Oh, I see. Okay. And are you in Parliament when Parliament is in session? Do you sit in Parliament?
Yes, certainly. We sit in front of the Speaker at the table of the House. And formally, just recently, it has been changed. We were wigged and gowned. Now I believe my ex-colleagues are just gowned and not wigged.
Okay, so just as well you're not there anymore, because you looked rather grand in the picture I saw of you sitting there in the House of Commons. But also, when were you there? You were there through quite an exciting time, weren't you? I mean, you worked with the big names that we can relate to in recent history, Harold Wilson, Ted Heath, Enoch Powell, Michael Foot, Ian Paisley, Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, Cameron, you've been with them all.
Yes, that's right. I just totted up out of to remind myself, really, and I came up with a list of 8 prime ministers and 7 speakers that I've seen. The 8 prime ministers include Harold Wilson, who was prime minister when I first arrived in the late 60s.
I suppose it's not fair of me to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, and you can say, no, it's not fair. If there was one of those characters that earned your absolute respect...
It isn't fair, but anyway, why not be unfair? I think John Major, I had tremendous admiration for John Major, partly because he went through a very difficult period as Prime Minister, largely because of his own party, by the way. But he always remained calm, well-mannered, and rational. And I thought that was an amazing performance, given the background.
Yes. And do you have any, shall we say, sympathy for Theresa May at the moment and the constitutional crisis that seems to be unfolding there?
Yes, of course. I think Theresa has inherited an extremely difficult mantle, if I can put it that way. And it would have been difficult for anyone who had been the Prime Minister. Mm. Both major parties are divided on the Brexit issue. And therefore, whoever was the Prime Minister would have faced constant problems with their own party.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, she's going to look back on this one day and think, my goodness, did I actually get through that? If she does get through it.
Absolutely, yes.
Sir Malcolm Jack is my guest here on People of Note this week. And I think let's have another piece of music, Malcolm. And Mozart is on your list.
Mozart's Oboe Concerto? Mm-hmm. Yes, I've always had a slight penchant for wind rather than string instruments. I'm not quite sure why, something to do with my ears, but anyway.
Okay. Here's the third movement of Mozart's Oboe Concerto.
Thank you.
That's the third movement of Mozart's Oboe Concerto, and that recording featured Randall Wolfgang as the oboist with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, and another choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, brought to you by Peter Tureen Productions, Sir Malcolm Jack, whose new book, To the Fairest Cape, European Encounters in the Cape of Good Hope, has just been published, and is, as you've heard when we talked about it just now, really quite a fascinating read. Malcolm, we were talking about you in Parliament, but you retired. How long ago did you retire?
7 years ago, actually.
Gosh, but then you say, you just mentioned while we were listening to that music that you're still very much involved. How come?
I'm president of something called the Constitution Society UK, which is a think tank, if you like to call it that, independent, of course, which gives views about all sorts of constitutional matters. So sometimes in that capacity, or simply because of being formally the clerk of the House, I'm called to give evidence, for example, to select committees.
And you've been doing that quite recently, in fact, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I gave evidence only 2 weeks ago to one of the leading committees looking at the longer-term constitutional implications of Brexit.
Okay. And do you, as this organization, do the MPs consult with you, or how does it work? What does the organization do?
There's an advisory board on which certain MPs sit.
Right, right.
And otherwise, yes, there's a sort of bilateral contact with individual MPs and so on.
And how did it come about, I must ask you, that you got your title, sir? Is that a result of your sterling work in Parliament?
Yes, that's right. Yes, it was given in recognition of parliamentary service.
Were you surprised?
Not really.
Well, it's always good to have a sir in the studio here with us, Sir Malcolm Jack. I want to just talk a little bit about your background, because what I find quite interesting, and you've told me about this before, is that although you were born in the UK, you went to Hong Kong when you were only a few months old with your father in the colonial service. And that must have been a fairly exotic experience for you. Your father, Hong Kong, and a Portuguese family, mother.
Yes, that's right. Yes, of course, I wasn't aware of being taken
no,
to the Far East at that age. But it was indeed. And I think it had enormous influence on me in due course.
I saw as well that you had put into the hands of a Chinese ama, a nanny, I suppose, an orphan from the convent, who spoke to you in Cantonese. And this is an unusual way for a British boy to be brought up, isn't it?
Yes, I think it was quite unusual. My parents were both very liberal in this sense. And, of course, my mother's family had a long connection with the Far East. So when they thought that Nanny was speaking to me in Cantonese, they said, oh, that's fine. And in fact, they came to the conclusion her Cantonese was better than her English anyway. So I may as well learn one language properly.
So did you end up I think you said you spoke Cantonese better than English at one stage.
Yes, I think the first time my dad had leave, as they used to call it, long leave, we went back to England. I was 4 years old, and I'm told that I spoke Cantonese better than English.
Can you still speak it?
I can, yes.
Sort of fluently? You can boast now if you like.
I can speak it fluently for, I would say, everyday purposes. Okay. You know, I couldn't give a lecture in Cantonese.
Could you write a book in Cantonese?
I have a very limited writing of Chinese script.
Okay. Malcolm, all this must have had a huge influence on you, the background in Hong Kong, the nanny, your father, and returning to English to England with all these sort of influences. How would you describe the influence it had on you?
It's quite difficult to describe, but of course, as we all know nowadays, psychologists say that the very early period of your life is, in fact, the most significant. I think when I first went back to England, there was a degree of suppression of this background, and that was very common with boys who or girls who came from the colonies, because we were different in some ways. And as everyone knows, no teenager wants to be thought of as different from his contemporaries. So I think during that period, there was a bit of suppression. But later on, I realized that, in fact, having a completely new view, if you like, from a different culture of the world was very important in my own psyche.
At this time of your life, did you have any idea of sort of a career path you wanted to follow?
Not so much. I think I've just been talking recently to some of my ex-university students in Singapore as to how difficult life now is for students. In other words, they're always worried about their careers and so on. We came from the halcyon days, really, when one trundled along and didn't think that much about what one was going to do, although certain paths were more obvious than others.
And then we're now talking about your teenage years, aren't we? But you say that you were probably destined to pursue an academic career, but then things changed to the House of Commons.
Yes, that's right. At that time, I was at the London School of Economics, and there was talk of getting a junior fellowship there. But unfortunately, I decided that the direction the department was going in wasn't really one that interested me so much. At the same time, I had applied for the civil service exams, and that is the way into the higher public service in the UK. They're known as the Mandarin exams, by the way.
Oh, that's a bit of a coincidence, isn't it? Cantonese, yes. Mandarin.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, really? Are they known in the UK as the Mandarin?
Well, the class used to be known as the Mandarin class, mm-hmm. And it's you see it sometimes in journalists' reports. They say the Whitehall Mandarins say this and that.
Oh, okay, used in that sense. Right, we're going to take another music break, Malcolm, and I see we've got something that I probably have never heard, a Welsh lullaby. So tell me what we're going to hear.
Oh, this is just a lullaby that's sung to little babies to soothe them, and maybe I was attracted to it because I needed soothing. It's just so beautiful, I'm sure that your listeners will enjoy it.
It's called Sleep in Peace, Suban. Is that correct pronunciation?
That's right. Yes.
Suban, Sleep in Peace. Here it is, a Welsh lullaby.
Thank you.
as you said, Malcolm, certainly very beautiful and certainly new, a Welsh lullaby called Suban, Sleep in Peace. Another choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, Sir Malcolm Jack. And I've been talking about his latest book, To the Fairest Cape, European Encounters in the Cape of Good Hope. Malcolm, you spoke about getting into Parliament after the School of Economics and all that, but you also seem to have had a very active career as a lecturer and a writer, because this is not by any means your only book. How did the writing begin?
Well, I think it never left me, actually. You know, I was told by a friend of mine that actually writers don't choose to be writers. Writing chooses them. And I think that's pretty true. The context is that, of course, when I started my career in the public service, it was a very different world. There was no iPhone, there was no internet.
Mm.
And although we had very long hours and the house used to sit all night sometimes, when it did not sit, you were free. So that meant in the summer recess, which was about 2.5 to 3 months, you were free. And you were free either to play cricket, if you wanted to, the whole summer, or to write. And for me, it was writing.
Did you ever play cricket, purely as a matter of interest?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And in fact, Rodney, that was a useful passport to school in England, because although boys from abroad were regarded as slightly odd, they were accepted because they could play cricket.
Ah, and had you learned cricket in China?
In Hong Kong,
In Hong Kong, I should say, yes, as it was then. Yes. And so most of your books are, there's a variety of topics as well, as far as I can see, in the books that you've written. Corruption and Progress, the 18th Century Debate, William Beckford and English Fidalgo, Sinatra, Sintra, A Glorious Eden, Lisbon, City of the Sea. So Portugal has sort of inveigled itself into your life very much, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, yes. After my family had returned to the UK when my father retired, they did a little stint in Sussex by the sea near Brighton. And after a very severe winter, decided that after all it wasn't for them, and they moved to live in Lisbon. So I had a close association with Lisbon from a very early period.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you do go back to Lisbon, because what I was about to say, Malcolm, is you are so, I want to say, addicted to Cape Town. You have a house here. You spend, as you said, a lot of time here. What about Lisbon?
I still do go to Lisbon, yes. I must admit now, for shorter periods. I have a dear cousin there, and she's my sort of surrogate sister. So I have to go and see her every now and again.
Okay. And the lecturing side of your life? Because you also said you had students in Singapore. You've done a huge amount of lecturing, haven't you?
Yes, I have, yes. Particularly as a guest speaker here and there. I did a stint in Yale in America and one in Coimbra. I've done some lecturing here, by the way, at UCT. But principally, I spent half a year in Singapore, one of the leading universities there. And that's where I did most of it.
I hope this is not a stupid question, but what subjects did you lecture on?
Although I was in the English department at NTU, I actually lectured on history of ideas, really, and philosophy. So I did a course from the 18th century to Freud, rather long stretch.
Yes, I see. And also, okay, so it's coming across just how eclectic your interests are as well. But I was wondering, with a background in China like that, in Singapore, and I know that you love music, you love art, is Chinese art is so special, isn't it? Do you collect at all?
Yes, I do, and I always have done, and so have my parents. One of my regrets is that one of my mother's relatives had an amazing collection of Chinese art, particularly Ming ceramics, and they were dispersed at one stage, was very shocking.
I'm sure. But at least you've got a collection both here and in London, have you?
In London, mainly.
In
yes.
London. And Malcolm, the other thing is, when you are completely relaxed, do you keep an interest up in what's happening in Parliament? Do you sit here in South Africa listening carefully to what's going on constitutionally in the UK?
Yes, I at the moment I think I have to say yes, because we are in such an extraordinary period.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read my Times every day, digitally, of course.
Yes.
And yes, I do. I think at other times I'm more relaxed about it.
Is it true that it is really an unusual time? And that's being bandied about. They're calling it the biggest constitutional crisis, possibly the century. Is this true? Certainly from this angle, it seems to be.
Yes, I think there is some hyperbole in the descriptions, obviously. But I think, yes, this has tested both Parliament and the country, by the way, because, mm-hmm. as you know, Rodney, the whole country is completely divided.
Indeed.
On this issue. And it's led to quite a shift in power from the government to Parliament.
That is interesting, because Parliament is where it's all happening, so to speak, isn't it? Even more so than the government. I hadn't thought about that before, because as you say, both parties, the Tories and the Labour Party, seem to be divided on this whole Brexit issue. So it's Parliament that the country is looking to, not government.
Yes, that's right. And I think that recent events, including some decisions by the Speaker of the House of Commons, have meant that, if I can put it this way, the parliamentary teeth have sharpened. So Parliament has got more direct influence on what government is doing than it had done before.
Is that possibly a good thing?
I think it's a good thing. Mm. I'm not the least bit worried about it. Some people are. But I don't see why government shouldn't be held to account in a more direct way.
Absolutely. Well, now, I think let's relax with another piece of music. And I see you've chosen a nocturne by Chopin. And you say Chopin is quite special to you.
Yes, I've always loved the nocturnes and other pieces of his, of course.
Absolutely. It's a nocturne number 15 in F minor, opus 55, number 1. Thank you. one of Chopin's nocturnes there, number 15 in F minor, opus 55, number 1, and another choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions, and that is Sir Malcolm Jack, who's written a book called To the Fairest Cape, European Encounters in the Cape of Good Hope. And we're going to come back to that in a moment, but Sir Malcolm, one of the many things I wanted to ask you, gosh, and there's so much to ask you, is when I asked you about lecturing, you spoke about constitutional matters and so on, but somewhere I read or I see here that you have a particular interest in 18th century political theory, the writings of Mary Wortley Montagu and William Beckford, for example. What is it that attracts you to that?
Well, I think I did my doctoral thesis on the 18th century, and that really was the origin of my interest in the 18th century. But I guess also I'm attracted to the so-called Enlightenment.
Oh, yes.
For reasons of its rationality and its egalitarianism as mm-hmm. well.
And to get back to the book then just briefly, on the cover you have a painting by a well-known painter called Les Vallons. That is quite a thing to put on your cover. Why did you choose that?
He's quite a hero of mine, and actually this relates straight back to the previous thing we were discussing, which was about the Enlightenment and the 18th century. Les Vallons came here, and he was ornithologist, interested in birds and collecting, but he was also a great disciple of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Rousseau was the leading exponent, really, of this notion of the noble savage, mm-hmm. although he didn't actually use the term himself, but he called it the good savage, le bon sauvage. But anyway, so there's a direct link between Les Vallons and Rousseau.
Right, so is there a link then between that and a rather, I would like to say, contentious title to one of your chapters, Ennobling the Savage. In these tricky times, one has to be careful what one says or writes.
Yes, I do realize that, and I was aware of that when I used that title, but I'm using it in this very specific 18th century context. Mm-hmm. And it was used in a way to attack European society, because the idea from Rousseau and other theorists who use these terms was that in some respects, the so-called, and I say this, repeat it, so-called primitive societies were in fact societies where men were free. And Rousseau begins, there's a famous remark ascribed to him that man was born free, but everywhere he is in chains. So there's a political, ideological background to this term, the noble mm-hmm. savage.
Right. And I mean, the other thing is this whole business of colonialism, which you sort of have to deal with in a book like this, don't you?
Yes, that's right. And I think what I hope is, and I recently had a conversation with a Singapore friend of mine, which was interesting because he read the book very much from that point of view. And what he said was, and I think he's spot on, that the book illustrates the whole complexity of the subject. You know, that there was this, as I say in the title, encounter. And what did the encounter mean to whom? It meant different things to different people. There were good and bad sides. Of course there were bad sides. One knows that, and I don't hesitate to describe them in the book.
In your book. And may I ask, this might also be a naive question, have you ever met, dealt with actual Khoisan people?
I have met one Khoisan person, yes, once in Cape Town, and I had a conversation with him.
That must have been fascinating, especially with your interest in this.
Yes, very fascinating. And I hope that the book is readable and interesting. But if it in any way helps the Khoisan cause, then I'm very pleased about that. Mm-hmm.
I just want to read a little excerpt here from Chris Saunders, who's Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Cape Town. And this sort of, I think, makes one want to settle down and read this book. Anyone interested in travelers' accounts will want to read Malcolm Jack's lively and well-researched discussion of how visitors from the Portuguese in the late 15th century to Lady Herschel in the 1830s viewed Cape and its people, along with sometimes colorful accounts the travelers gave of what they saw as the exotic landscape, fauna and flora of the Cape. Malcolm Jack focuses on their perceptions of the indigenous Khoisan, perceptions that helped shape the way the early colonial society developed. Now, that's a very, very complimentary thing to say. He's tied up many of your sort of narrative themes there into one. And even Lady Herschel, the wife of the astronomer, wasn't she, and the musician?
That's right, yes. She was the wife of the astronomer, as you say. The Herschels were not entirely at ease with Cape colonial society. They sort of somewhat kept to themselves. But her diaries are delightful. By the way, I mustn't not include Lady Anne Bernard, of course, because mm-hmm. she will be very familiar to many of your listeners. And she is also a heroine of mine.
Oh, okay. Why?
I think because her diaries are so well written, and her sketches and paintings, which I'm sure people are familiar with, are also very poignant. Her sketches, for example, of her own staffer and servants are extremely sympathetic.
Mm-hmm. Well, is the book then, just to end, Sir Malcolm, because we need to close off now, is this book, would you say, aimed at academics, or are you hoping it's a good read for someone who's just jolly interested in European encounters in the Cape of Good Hope?
I wrote it particularly for a wide readership, although I hope that it's properly researched and
yes,
backed
sure.
up.
Okay. Well, we're going to end with something rather lighter, but before you introduce it, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing some very interesting thoughts and also a kind of inside peek into the House of Commons in which you spend so many years, Sir Malcolm Jack. Your last piece is a little bit of a surprise, perhaps.
The King and I?
Yes.
Yes, I think something rather jaunty. I always feel that it's so uplifting, and Yul Brynner and Deborah Carr were just amazing in the film.
Okay, this is The King and I, and what better than Shall We Dance? So Malcolm Jack, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've just been introduced. I do not know you well, but when the music started, something drew me to your side. So many men and girls are in each other's arms. It made me think we might be similarly occupied. Shall we cloud of music, shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Or perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? On a clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen, shall we dance, shall we dance, shall we dance?
Why do you stop? Oh. You dance pretty. Go on, go on, go on.
Oh, Your Majesty, I didn't realize. After all, I'm not a dancing girl. In England, no woman would dance alone while a man is looking at her.
But you will dance with strange man, holding hands, etc.
Yes, but not always a stranger. Usually a very good friend.
Good, then we'll dance together. You show me. Teach, teach, teach.
Well, it's quite simple, a polka. You count 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3, and... Shall we dance?
1, 2, 3, and...
On a bright cloud of music, shall we fly?
1, 2, 3, and...
Shall we dance?
1, 2, 3, and...
Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye?
1, 2, 3, and...
Or perchance,
when the last little star has lit the sky,
shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? On the clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen,
shall we dance? Shall we dance? Shall we dance?
Now!
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Something wrong. I know, no, I forget then. Next time I remember.
1, 2, 3, and 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 1, 2, 3.
Splendid,
Your Majesty.
Splendid, splendid. You throw me off count. And 1, 2, 3,
and 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3, and 1.
But it's not right.
Oh, yes, it is. You were doing beautifully, Your Majesty.
No, no. Not the way I see Europeans dancing tonight.
Yes, it was. It was just like that.
We're not holding two hands like this.
No. As a matter of fact,
was a... like this. Now?
Yes.
Come.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Peter Turin and Kickstart invite you to take a musical journey into a world where nothing is as it seems. From the 30th of January to the 2nd of March, revel in Stephen Sondheim's sublime musical, Into the Woods, starring Kate Normington, Earl Gregory, Ashley Harvey, and a star-studded cast at Theatre on the Bay. Go into the woods where witches can be right, giants can be good. You decide what's right, you decide what's good. Into the Woods, only at Theatre on the Bay from January the 30th.
FMR.